Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening and welcome to the Coffee Clatch. The Coffee Clatch and Special Needs Talk Radio Network feature outstanding programming for the special needs community. Our team of hosts provide educational interviews. Our shows are not designed to provide listeners with specific or personal medical, legal, or professional service or advice. Parents of children with health issues should always consult their health care provider for medical advice, medications, or treatment. Any show discussing rights and law for special needs children and special education are presented as general information and not legal advice. Special Needs Coffee Clatch Limited does not promote any host or guest's individual practice, programs, treatments, or products. We thank you for joining us and are proud to provide excellence in broadcasting for the special needs community. And now, on to the interview.
Good evening. Welcome to the Coffee Clatch. First, please allow me to recognize our founder, Marianne Russo, and co-moderator, May Wilkinson, who will be helping out with our Twitter tweet chat tonight. And tonight, our guest is Dr. Zachary Warren. Dr. Warren has a unique perspective on autism. He is the director of the Vanderbilt Kennedy Center for Treatment and Research Institute for Autism Spectrum Disorders, also known as TRIAD, and is the director of Autism Clinical Services. As the name TRIAD implies, Dr. Warren and his staff are actively engaged in the research, treatment, and education of children on the autism spectrum. Dr. Warren, welcome to the Coffee Clatch.
Thank you very much.
Dr. Warren, can you please tell us a little bit about TRIAD?
Yeah, so TRIAD is a part of a larger center at Vanderbilt. It's a part of an intellectual and developmental disability research center, Eunice Kennedy Shriver, IDDRCs, as they're sort of coined now, and their centers essentially for advancing research and science for understanding developmental disorders, including autism. And TRIAD is an institute housed within that center that is essentially devoted to facilitating clinical services training programs and research programs that are designed to help families of individuals with autism and individuals with autism themselves in a number of different capacities. It's been around for about 20 years or so. I've been with and affiliated with TRIAD for about 5 years. And sort of how we started was in a fairly rural state. The former director, Dr. Wendy Stone, really utilized the university and the university's name to develop a statewide sort of training and learning collaborative network with the Department of Education. And really that has been sort of the cornerstone of our work for the past couple of decades, really developing networks to try and train, teach, and reach as many parts of Tennessee and basically the region now. In addition to doing those training activities, TRIAD's been devoted to facilitating the development and enhancement of clinical services, primarily with our attachment and affiliation with the Children's Hospital. So I direct some of our autism services or help organize our autism services within the pediatric hospital right now, really trying to develop model systems for not only identification, but more effective handoff to service systems. And then a huge component of what we do as well is really to try and partner with research scientists, and this is either through sort of consortium research programs or with the scientists from all the different disciplines, biomedical to very behavioral at Vanderbilt, to help provide them with the resources, technical expertise and consultation to make sure that they're able to do the work that they want to do. So that's a bit about TRIAD. I've been with them for 5 years, directing it for the past 2 years. I'm a clinical psychologist by training. I actually got into working in this field. My graduate work was more in terms of working with infants and toddlers who had experienced severe abuse, trauma, and neglect in inner city Miami years and years and years ago, and really was very interested in understanding, the implications that those adverse conditions really had for impacting social and communication development in a really deleterious way. And that expertise in terms of understanding social and communication sort of development really lended me more to working with trying to understand autism in its earliest form. So that's probably a lengthier explanation than you wanted, but that's background.
No, that's great. Now, you've recently published a comparative effectiveness review titled Therapies for Children with Autism Spectrum Disorders. Can you give us a parental executive summary of your study?
Sure. So I think the first thing to know about that study is this is a study that was commissioned, and it was commissioned by the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality, which is an organization that's really committed towards trying to understand interventions, therapeutics that can be translated on a consumer level. So taking sort of you know, what we know, whether that be about autism or whether that be about a, you know, a medication for overactive bladder, mm-hmm. you know, or oftentimes
right.
sponsored through these EPC networks, you know, what do we really know? And this was a topic that was nominated to ARC through Autism Speaks and then also the Medicaid sort of learning collaborative. So the state Medicaid medical directors really are in the position of really trying to figure out how best to serve individuals with autism in many different capacities and having to make financial decisions that I would hate to be making myself, but they're in that position of having to do that, particularly in a time where it's really tight in terms of making those decisions based on a lot of resources. But that's the summary of how that was conducted. And then basically what we do is we apply EPC techniques, so evidence-based practice centers. There's a network of them around North America, and they have very specific sort of methodologies for saying, okay, let's go after, you know, all of the literature there and through a specific design try and synthesize it down to levels that would speak to either specific outcomes or specific populations or specific decisions. And so that was the focus of this initial report, was to say, well, what do we really know? And this was the original report was for children explicitly. It was for individuals who were 12 and under and their families and saying, what do we know about services? And we did a comprehensive literature survey and tried to break that down on a level of saying, you know, really what do we know about the strength of the evidence that exists there? And mm-hmm. unusual is the wrong word for it, but it's a hard approach to understand because they talk about strength of evidence ultimately in these EPC reports. So they're saying, you know,
right.
do we have the data that suggests X, Y, and Z? And oftentimes what we found, unfortunately, in terms of many areas of the research for autism spectrum disorders, we don't yet have the data that really help us on a consumer level understand what specifically we need to be doing for a specific child, for a specific family, in a specific community, and know what the results are going to be. You know, a lot of people, and so in many respects, there's insufficient evidence for helping guide a lot of these key decisions that need to be made and that we think are going to have potentially very potent effects in terms of neurodevelopmental trajectory. We just don't have the evidence that we want to have. You know, in terms of what we did find strength of evidence for was certainly within the field of sort of intensive educational behavioral interventions, developmental interventions, some brands of ABA packages are starting to mount evidence bases that are stronger and stronger. Unfortunately, some of the methods are still weaker than we would like to see, and there are some novel interventions for even younger children that are thinking about a more developmentally appropriate methodology for applied behavior analysis services for very, very young children. And then within the medication field, there's also some evidence that specific medications work for a specific set of behaviors. Unfortunately, those behaviors are pretty limited to, you know, irritability, aggression, agitation, not run-of-the-mill core symptoms that we know of autism. And the medications that had the mm-hmm. data often have really, really potent side effects that go along with them,
right.
too. And, you know, one of the hardest parts about this study is that what we're talking about, interventions that oftentimes are delivered in complex combinations over long periods of time, it's really hard to study these things. You really have to put a lot of resources behind it to give us the answers that we want. So end of the day, a couple things come out. There are a couple of complementary alternative interventions that, despite early sort of promise, just we had strength of evidence for saying, hey, that's not there anymore, and that was with secretin.
Mm-hmm.
For early intensive behavioral interventions, there's a mounting but still low strength of evidence in terms of understanding how UCLA and LOBOS-based ABA approaches are going to impact preschool-age children, right? Their age range is kind of restricted. And then we had a fairly strong moderate to high for a couple of atypical antipsychotic medications in terms of being able to treat symptoms of irritability, aggression, etc. So that's a long explanation
right.
again, but it's it's hard. I think one of the things that was hard for us about doing this report is that we knew that there would be a certain interpretation on some side that when this would hit popular media, that there would be a smaller percentage that would say these researchers are saying that things don't work for autism. And that's not what's being said at all. What's being said is
right.
We don't have the evidence that we want to have, that we need to have on that consumer and clinician level to be able to help. You know, as a clinician who's essentially devoted my life to, in my professional life, to helping individuals with autism and their families, that was a tough thing to know going into this report, that there would be a certain percentage of take that would come out that way. You know, I don't like to look at popular press with things around this, but there were a few, and our center certainly loves this. This is what they do, right? They're trying to call attention to developmental disabilities and
right. The
need for more mm-hmm. service research, et cetera. But there were some articles coming out saying, Dr. Warren says, there's no evidence that therapies work for children with autism. And,
right.
That's not what we were saying at all. But and the important
right.
thing behind this, too, was that we knew we were going to get that flack. So some might say, why do this at all? But at the end of the day, what this is doing is really putting out there, and not just to folks who have had to live this before, right, of living that process of saying, I would do anything that I possibly could for my child, and not having folks who could point them in a particular direction, but also for those who are really in the position of power for making decisions, of saying, we knew we would ultimately get to the hands of, state, Medicaid directors who would be saying, okay, I
right.
need to be doing something here. What should I be doing? And so it's tricky, and it's an interesting climate sometimes, the field of autism spectrum disorders amongst researchers, parents, clinicians, et cetera. Sometimes we can line up in a circular firing squad rather than getting all together, sometimes. And
yeah.
we're a little worried about some of that. But at the end of the day, I think what this hopefully said is that we know some things, but it's far too limited, and we need to be redoubling our efforts in a major way to really, tackle this problem. And the next step we're involved with now is saying, it's certainly not enough to be talking about young children and early identification and early intervention. And we were commissioned to do a companion to this that is basically talking about, well, tell us about young adulthood and tell us about the
uh-huh.
transition from adolescence to young adulthood, because
right.
if you think
right.
there's a low strength of evidence for therapies and interventions and plans for young children, then oh my goodness, let's talk about adolescence and young adulthood and say we
right.
really need in a desperate way to be focusing on research here and research that matters.
Right.
So, again, that was a bit of a monologue to a very simple question, but how I summarize the research.
Uh-huh. Well, aside from that study, can you share with us any potential breakthroughs that you have seen when it comes to autism research?
In terms of, what's coming, what am I interested in, or what do I think are novel sort of ways of thinking about it, or is,
what are novel ways of thinking about it? What is there any promise out there with the research? Has your research shown any kinds of, is early intervention, are we
sure.
seeing any kind of breakthroughs with
yeah.
with early intervention or things like that?
I think I'm most excited about, but this is my bias, right? I told you, why I got into studying things in general.
Sure.
I'm just interested in early social communication development in infants and toddlers, and that runs across the spectrum, not just the autism spectrum, but the spectrum of, typical to many different difficulties. I think I'm really excited by the prospect that we now have in hand and having mounted evidence for this idea that we are capable of putting into play systems of care that can meet comprehensive needs of very, very young children at risk for autism, or where we were able to identify it at a much younger age. So I really, think about this model, and certainly that Jerry Dawson and Sally Rogers have put out in the Early Start Denver model, which has said, okay, well, we don't want to be drilling 18-month-olds around certain skills. We need to find out effective, comprehensive intervention paradigms that can meet them where they are, and really robust robustly unpack where they're going to go. And, you know, seeing data that can make those shifts from children who are accurately identified under 2 years of age and who they've followed up at 4 and who are now being followed up at 6, where within the context of that type of study, I think they're moving towards, at least for some individuals, not all, but for some individuals, they can, in an ethically appropriate manner, talk about prevention or recovery. That to me is very exciting. The limits
really?
Are obvious. And this is not for all, right? But this is for some children where
right.
we're able to identify before 2 years of age, really apply state-of-the-art methodologies that, quite frankly, aren't necessarily available to the folks that we would like them to be available to right now in wide form, but are developing. That, you know, following up now at age 6, that there are some children where clinicians are able to say, wow, I'm not sure that I would be talking about this child as displaying any impairment at this point in time. Now, that's not the majority, but what that's telling me is that it is a worthwhile prospect towards thinking about how can we go lower and lower and lower and lower in terms of early development so that we could impact sort of core skills that are going to feed and cascade into really nice social learning opportunities so
mm-hmm.
that children can be engaged in more of the ways that their folks and those in their environment would like them to be engaged and can learn more through some of those processes. So that's very exciting to me. I think it's also very exciting to be working with larger and larger and larger studies that are looking for the various different causes of autism and seeing some of those play out, not in the numbers that we would like to, but at certainly now being able to identify, examples of what we would hope would happen for a majority of individuals over time, that we might be able to identify specific early differences in terms of genetic profile that in some cases might be linked to, let's say, a metabolic disorder or linked to, the inability to synthesize a specific protein, and that we might have ways of remediating some of that early in development. That's exciting to me. Again, this is not happening on the level that I would like to, but on some of the genetics collections, they're now identifying small, copy number variants that are linked to specific biological processes, and those specific biological processes can be attended to. Not necessarily in curative ways at this point, but it's a push. It's where things are moving, not as fast as we would like it, but those are promising.
So do you think this kind of research is, or these tests that you foresee, are these something that would be done with a child in her, very early days or months of infancy, or would it be something done in utero or even before that? Would it be genetic testing with
parents? I don't think it would be anything that would be done, and we're not at that level at
right.
all. But
okay.
we're probably able to do better in terms of more realistic, more appropriate sort of plans of terms of surveillance and screening this started out, heel pricks and blood samples for newborns, started for a very, very small percentage of that. It'll move forward with that. The other part of this, too, is that, autism, we know, has a huge neurogenetic influence, but it's not all neurogenetics at the same time. You can look at identical twins, and you can look at some of the twin samples, and you'll say, well, those folks sharing 100% of their genetic material or really, really sizable percentages, they're not sharing the diagnosis 100% of the time. That tells us that there's something else very complex affecting that neurogenetic development that's going to make it imminently complex to figure out how to help there. I do think, though, being involved with some of the prospective sibling studies, so this is for families who are interested in participating in studies where they have a child with autism and have had a new baby, and they're mm-hmm. oftentimes some are not monitoring at all, some are intensively monitoring. I had my first child 1 month after I started, devoted myself to running autism clinics, and I was watching my children like a hawk just because of my exposure.
Right.
But there
right.
were prospective infant studies of being able to say, okay, well, there might be some ways, and they're not going to be simple observations. They're not going to be simple genetic tests. They're going to be a complex paradigms of being able to pair together biological and behavioral data to say we need to be attending to something here. Something matters here, and it's likely going to be a combination. And a complex combination of markers, and it's not something that I think will be something we can pinpoint at one point in time. I think the complexities of autism really suggest to me that, you know, fundamentally it is a disorder of learning early on, right? And learning
mm-hmm.
is a dynamic process. It's not something that's static. But if we're
right.
able to,
right.
via complex behavioral and biological sort of methods, understand where learning trajectories are differing, right?
Mm-hmm.
Then we might be able to kind of make an impact on that trajectory itself. That's
yeah.
when you get into the realm of talking about prevention for me, or talking about of really exciting developments early on. So
yeah.
those are some of the things that I'm very interested in. I'm also very interested in, you know, the scientists, and this isn't what I do, but some of my close colleagues are very interested in understanding, you know, different models, genetic models of the disorder, and thinking about ways of mapping that onto treatments. So, you know, certainly people have been doing this in the realm of Fragile X, and Fragile X and autism are not synonymous, but, you know, there's certainly a co-occurrence there, and I think there will be other models over time. The unfortunate reality, I think, for the genetic world is that genetics is pretty darn complex, right? And I
yeah.
think what we've
yeah.
already learned in a short period of time is that there is not a genetic answer for autism, that there are likely
right.
hundreds of genetic contributions, and not cause
mm-hmm.
necessarily contributions to what we know about autism spectrum disorders.
Right.
So being able to break that down is going to be very, 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 very complex. But it might give us more yield in terms of where we stand now. You know, one of the things about our report is that, you know, we couldn't, you know, pinpoint for an individual child how do we need to meaningfully vary this in a level that's going to make more impact on that learning trajectory. What now we do is pretty much apply fairly standard models of what we think best practice should look like, right? You know, and we do that from a behavioral and educational angle, and we are often talking about lots of services, many hours a week over long periods
yes.
of time. But being able
yes.
to tell a family, you know, well, you know, based on these other sort of things, these are the specific things that really need to be tied in there, right? Or these are the things
yes.
that you should be able to expect in terms of return. I think that's another hard
right.
thing. Too, you know, I think,
yes.
You know, not being able to comment on that idea of where this is necessarily going to go is a really hard thing when you're sitting with a family at 2 years of age and talking about autism.
Yep.
I think good parents really want to know, you know, is this autism? If so, what do I do about it, right? And then the most
right.
meaningful
okay,
question
so,
perhaps is, over time, what does this mean?
Right. So, okay, so, you know, fast forward 12 years, 15 years, you know, especially it's as close to me, you know, my son is, he's getting through his junior year in high school, and now the post high school years are coming on. So parents with young teens and young adults, what should we be doing to help with our kids at this stage? You know, this, do you have any advice for, you know, for helping our kids, you know, it not early intervention, but, you know, we know what we're dealing with. We know our kids are, we want our kids to get out there and be able to interact in society. And so what should we be doing for our children at this point?
Right. You know, I think there's a really, one of my colleagues here, Eric Carter, in special education at Vanderbilt, really wonderful guy who does a lot of research with individuals with severe intellectual disabilities, not autism specifically, but sometimes autism, and really focuses in on this period of, you know, transitioning from high school to non-high school, and thinking about it from one of the capacities that I think most parents have as a marker of sort of success to a certain extent, and that is thinking about jobs or occupation or employment or other
right.
sort of opportunities. And I was listening to him speak to one of sort of his projects that was embedded within Wisconsin, where he came from before here, was really doing some longitudinal work and saying, you know, what is it that we need to be doing to really be fostering better outcomes? You know, I mean, because and he was presenting, mm-hmm. you know, the scary data that I think we're all fairly and acutely aware of not necessarily feeling like individuals with autism are adequately employed or employed at all at the percentages we would like to see, and that's certainly when economies are taking downturns, that even takes, another impact in terms of what's happening. One of the most interesting things I learned from looking at his work very closely was this idea of connection to community in a very, very broad sense. And so they were working with, you know, many different community partners to think about this. And it was this idea of finding those individuals within the communities that really connected folks in a powerful way. And it wasn't one-to-one. You know, so it was interesting. You know, there were different communities were doing this in very different ways. But the results that we were seeing for much more positive outcomes were for communities that were really getting together and talking about this idea with the people who had the ability to translate that throughout sort of employment or business sort of communities as well. You know, that they were actually sort of talking to the people who were involved in, you know, varied from where it was. Sometimes it was the guy who ran the local diners. Sometimes it was, you know, the more formal sort of, you know, Chamber of Commerce folks or the mayor or other individuals. But really this idea of if we want our children, our young adults, if we want individuals with autism writ large employed at a higher level within our community, one, we need to be talking about that employment and those opportunities, not, you know, once we're done, but we need to start talking about that very early on, and we probably need to be embedding that and priming that up very, very early within the educational sort of systems that children are involved with. And that, you know, one of the biggest predictors of later employment is prior employment, right? And that goes for you or I or anyone else. But that idea of, you know, if we're not having that all along the way, then that's a predictor that's not there. And if you're talking about an individual who might have some vulnerabilities towards achieving that ultimate outcome, then does that suggest that you should do less or wait? Or does that suggest that, oh my goodness, we actually need to be doing more earlier in a very explicit way about those opportunities if we want to push for that type of success? So, you know, that's, you know, I mean, you know, when you ask that question, I don't have an answer, right? You know, but when I think about those models that I think about success, those are the things that I start thinking about. When parents start asking that question very early on about, you know, that terror of sending their child off to college or their child living on their own in their first apartment and just saying like that, you know, and if I project, you know, from my 13-year-old or my 15-year-old, and I forget how old you said that your son or daughter was, I apologize, but, you know, if I project out at that point, you know, I'm scared, I don't know what to do. And it's like, well, we need to start thinking about, you know, the staircase, the steps that are going to get us from point A to B. And we're going to have to be very, very explicit, very concrete about this on a level that you probably don't want to be, right? You were hoping that, you know, a little bit of this would be a little bit more natural or osmotic or something like that. But it's really about if you want this to be happening, here's how we have to get very, very concrete and explicit about this. You know, I think, you know, it applies to jobs. It applies to independent sort of adaptive sort of skills. It applies to those topics that are hard for us to talk about, like sexuality, right? If you think it's, you know, that an individual that might have some developmental vulnerabilities needs less education or support in that area rather than more, then you might have some challenges, right? You know, I mean, I think that's I think what I'm coming to terms with that reality now. And the other part of that is that unfortunately we don't have great systems that are telling us exactly how they've done that before, right? And they don't have necessarily the models. But quite frankly, we don't have necessarily that even as we go down young and young and young, you know. And so I think you learn from the successes of other individuals, but I think that sense of connection to community, talking about this and doing something about that talk is what's very important.
Connection to community, talking about it, and doing something about the talk. That's actually some really good advice. Great advice. So, Dr. Ward, I have one last question for you, and I always like to ask my guests for a takeaway, you know, a solitary bit of advice for parents to carry as they journey, you know, through this maze and haze of autism. So can you give us one piece of advice that we can carry along?
Wow, that's a very, very tough question. yeah, it really is. I mean, I think... you know, in that way, I guess, you know, sort of my outer response is that there's not one answer. There's not one
right.
solution. And oftentimes
right.
there can be many, many, many different pathways to achieving the goals that you want to have. And sometimes those goals might even change along the way, but not necessarily become less valuable or less important.
Right.
You know, I often talk with parents who are either very concerned about their decision about what intervention service, this one versus that, or schools, is it this classroom versus that classroom, or as we move to middle schools, you know this
mm-hmm.
friend, that friend, this program, that, or as we're transitioning out, this one, this, and you know, sometimes my answer, my step back is just as a dad and a human being is we've got to take care of ourselves, take some of those deep breaths and understand that part of this is that this is a decision, right? Like this is not the
right.
decision. When I think about my own kids and decisions for school, it feels like the decision. I usually give
mm-hmm.
individuals sort of a feedback of like, it's okay to screw up every once in a while. You know, this is a decision.
Yep.
It's important that we make
yep.
it as best we can, but it is a decision. We're going to have lots of them. And there are many
yep.
opportunities for really kind of thinking about making good decisions and learning from some of those poor over time. So anyway, that's
yeah.
kind of a cop-out, but that's where I'd leave you.
Well, no, actually, Dr. Warren, that's not a cop-out at all. I think that's pretty good advice. You know, what I'm hearing you say is, you know, there is a direction, but there's not necessarily a path that we need to take. There may be many paths. And you said, don't be afraid to make a decision. And it's just a decision. It's not the decision. I think that's great advice. So, Dr. Warren, with that, we're out of time, but I really want to thank you for being on our show tonight. Greatly appreciate
sure
it.
All right. Take care.
All right. Thanks a lot.
All right.
All right, good night. And everybody, thanks a lot to the Coffee Clatch, and we will be talking to you later. Thanks a lot.